Welcome to the Jim Eakster Show. I'm Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. I'll be sitting in today for Jim. We have a special guest in the studio, Mr. Peter Kovacs, the new editor of The Advocate. He'll tell us how he is reshaping the local newspaper in Baton Rouge and building a new daily newspaper in New Orleans. Also on today's show, a talk about Carmageddon. Now, that was the traffic nightmare 1 year ago that haunts us still, an isobutane truck accident shut down the interstates and gridlocked Baton Rouge. The 27-hour ordeal had a fiery finish and left a lot of questions about emergency traffic management in our area. Here to talk about Carmageddon is Taylor Moss with the Louisiana State Police Emergency Services Unit and Lieutenant Todd Wisher with the Baton Rouge Police Department. Stay tuned. We'll be taking your calls. First, the news. Welcome back to the Jim Eakster Show. This is Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. I'm sitting in today for Jim Eakster, who will be back tomorrow. I want to thank Kevin Gallagher and Amy Jeffries handling the booth and some production today. And we have a very special guest in the studio, Mr. Peter Kovacs, who is the new editor of The Advocate. If you'd like to call in and talk to Peter and ask a question, the number in the Baton Rouge area is 297-5633. That's 297-5633 or toll free at 1-877-217-5757. Or you can email us at inksterhow@wrkf.org. Well, Peter, welcome. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, you have had a storied journalism career, and now probably one of the most interesting challenges of all, running the Advocate. You were with the Birmingham News, I guess, at one time, and then the Times-Picayune, where you were the editor. And for full disclosure, I said Peter hired me to come and join the Times-Picayune staff years ago, and I worked in the Capitol Bureau. Then I guess the owners of the Times-Picayune sort of did a reset and closed the company as we know it, sort of restarted a more digitally focused media company. And Peter had the opportunity to come and work for The Advocate under John Georges. So how has the ride been so far here in Baton Rouge?
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of work. It's been very rewarding. We're trying to do something that really no newspaper company in America has successfully done. In the days when the business was more lucrative, at various times, a newspaper from one market tried to bring their brand into another market in competition with an established newspaper. For example, in the 80s and 90s, the Los Angeles Times tried to compete with the newspaper in Orange County in Santa Ana, which was at the time a wealthy area south of L.A. And, you know, they built a building. They had 100 people. They had a parallel universe in Orange County, an Orange County restaurant writer and an Orange County prep sports writer, and they spent a lot of money and eventually left with their tail between their legs. I think we have a different dynamic and a much greater...
I sure hope so.
Pardon?
I sure hope so.
Yes, a much greater chance of success because we are providing a daily home-delivered newspaper to our customers in New Orleans, and we believe that that's what they want.
I see. Yeah, it is unusual. You have to... an all-out newspaper war going on down there, and a capable staff of a lot of former Times-Picayune people. But I think folks in our area are mainly wanting to hear about your plans for the Baton Rouge version of The Advocate. We see just recently you've made some cosmetic changes to the paper in terms of style. Tell us why you made those changes and what that's all about.
Well, you know, our challenge really is to have two cultures within the same company so that we have a culture that provides the New Orleans market with the newspaper they want and a culture that provides the Baton Rouge market with the newspaper they want.
So this is the LSU culture and that's the Saints culture? Is that
you know, in many ways. And we published, for example, a 92-page football section yesterday.
Yes, I've been reading it. And still reading it.
And if you should still be reading it because it has a lot of pages in it. And the cover, the New Orleans edition had a cover on the Saints, and the Baton Rouge edition had a cover on LSU.
You learn fast.
Yes, we did learn fast. But and one thing I think people don't understand, you know, sometimes I have people I meet with and I show them the different editions, and I don't think they understand how different they are and how much thought goes into trying to make them different. But we have, you know, most of the employees we have are in Baton Rouge. We print in Baton Rouge. So I don't think we have a problem in terms of having the culture of what Baton Rouge wants, you know, coursing through the veins of our company, even though the owner is from New Orleans.
Yeah, I think one of the hallmarks of the Advocate has been covering state politics. They've put in a lot of emphasis on that, not that the Picayune did not, but they seem to favor state politics almost over local politics in the paper, at least in the past regime. And they've been real leaders in standing up for open government and open public records and whatnot. Are you going to carry on that culture, or is that going to change?
Well, the Advocate, and you would know this, having been the bureau chief for the Times-Picayune, and the Advocate always had a bigger staff than the Times-Picayune at the state capitol. And it certainly does now, diminished due to the diminution of staffing at the Times-Picayune. And I think that's appropriate in a state capitol. I find people are very passionate about state issues here, much more so than in New Orleans. So I see that continuing. I think we have, you know, five terrific people in our Capitol Bureau. And as you know, having worked over there, they work in a little cramped space in the basement under the stairs.
They work hard. They're highly productive people. 297-5633, if you want to talk to Peter Kovacs, the new editor of The Advocate, who is here in town helping reformat and rethink The Advocate and blending it in with the Baton Rouge culture. If you want to speak with him or ask a question, 297-5633. What's it like working for your new boss, John Georges, the businessman who came in and bought the Advocate property from the Manships?
Well, he's been a terrific owner. He hasn't told me anything I should publish. He hasn't told me anything I shouldn't publish. He hasn't told me anyone I should hire. He hasn't told me anyone I shouldn't hire. Some of the people who have joined the Advocate are probably not people who he was a fan of their coverage when he was running for office, but he's been terrific and very supportive and has not, you know, told us what to do or how to regard the news in any way.
He's been a hands-off as far as editorial direction, but I understand he's been in town in the newsroom around town a lot.
He's in the building a good bit. He's to the extent he's in the newsroom, I think he's mostly walking through, showing groups the paper. He has been in town. He's spoken to various groups. I think he's speaking next week again. And he has a lot of contacts. He knows a lot of business people in Baton Rouge. You know, his company did business in Baton Rouge. He knows his way around town pretty well. I think he can find most anything without a GPS, which puts him ahead of me.
Well, the Picayune always had a style of looking at investigative pieces, enterprise pieces, a little more so, I think, than the Advocate. So now you've come to the Advocate. How are you changing the news focus and the depth and breadth of how you're going to approach this?
Well, I think the Advocate has, you know, I think the Advocate has a culture of skepticism of government and a culture of investigating government. I can't speak to what happened before I was there, but we, in the past 3 or 4 months, have uncovered the way in which the sheriff's office was arresting people for a crime that had been declared not to be a crime by the Supreme Court, and most of the, you know, most of the things you know about what's going on with CATS, the transit agency, you know, came from our coverage of it. And so I think the Advocate has a pretty good culture of investigative journalism.
We have Randy from Zachary. Randy has a question for you.
Randy.
Yes, I hope that your paper will continue heavy investigative reporting and really digging into things. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, and I appreciate that. Investigative reporting is hard and time-consuming, but I do think it's what people want and expect from a newspaper.
And we have Jim from Port Allen. Jim, you have a question for Peter Kovacs, the editor of The Advocate.
Yes, and I wonder why the national news is not on the front page anymore. We had 20% of the front page about a man staying in jail too long. Why we can't do a summary like the Wall Street Journal does in the left column?
Well, I find that, I mean, we do put national news on the front page sometimes, and I'm not sure we're putting it on there less than they were before I got there. But, you know, for the most part, the market for newspapers is covering local news. And in many cases, just because of the power of the Internet, a lot of the national news that people used to get in newspapers, they already know by the time the newspaper lands on their doorstep. But our experience is that they are less likely to, you know, they're less likely to know the local news unless they watch television, unless they watch the television news last night.
Well, thank you, Jim, for that question. Peter, what are the major changes that you are making or planning to make for The Advocate?
In Baton Rouge, our aim is for the most part to go slowly and try to understand the market better and, you know, learn what we can about local tastes. And for the most part, I listen to the people who've worked there for a long time. We did introduce some new design elements that I think should make the paper livelier. The design of The Advocate was probably, you know, a few years behind the way, you know, what's going on in the rest of the industry. I'm not sure that what's going on in the rest of the industry isn't a little too much, isn't a little too fancy and too elaborate, but we're trying to make the thing more attractive. I think we're trying to make it livelier, trying to put stories about how people live, not just cover government meetings.
You know, when people think about when you're changing the paper, they think, oh, what about that page one? What's going to be happening different there? But you're really talking about changes throughout the paper. And you created a new section, right?
We created a new lifestyle section that we think is more modern and relates more to how people live today. And
Eat, Play, Live. Thank you.
Yeah, Eat, Play, Live.
That's right.
And it has the elements that were in the old features sections are in there. One of the things you hear a lot about is, you know, the puzzles and the comics and all of that is still in there.
If you change those, you get a lot of calls, right. I guess.
I actually, I've been listening to calls. I've listened to, I think, every call, and I've looked, I think, at every email. And one of the issues that I never would have anticipated is the way the puzzle page is aligned in reference to the TV page and whether they should be back-to-back or not.
So these are the things we brought you in to consider and trying to figure out the future of The Advocate.
There are some people who think that the puzzle page should back up to the TV page so they can be torn out and retained. And then there are some people who think they should be not so that one person can do the puzzles and the other can watch television.
If you have a view of where the puzzles should go in The Advocate, Peter Kovacs is ready to take your question. 297-5633 here on the Jim Inkster Show. We have about one more minute before the break. And what about crime? You always hear people saying, oh, it covers too much crime. And then when you do the surveys, you find out readers really want to read about crime. What's your approach to emphasizing that?
I think people, I know people find crime to be a downer in the newspaper, but I do think you're correct. A lot of people say they don't want to read about crime, and then if the crime isn't in the newspaper, they're angry, or if it isn't prominent enough, they're angry. And I think readers actually, you know, like reading about crime and, you know, want to feel safe in their neighborhoods.
How about that? Peter Kovacs, we'll be back with him after this break. Sonny Landreth's going to take us out here. You'll be able to call and ask more questions, and we'll be talking about Carmageddon, the traffic lockup 1 year ago, next on the Jim Inkster Show. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. I'm Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council, sitting in for Jim today. And in our studio is Mr. Peter Kovacs, editor of The Advocate. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Peter. Then we're going to talk about Carmageddon. We have some state police and Baton Rouge Police Department folks who are going to be talking about that big incident a year ago and what has been done or not done about the type of traffic snarl that we saw. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 297-5633, 297-5633. Well, Peter, you also have charge, I guess, of the editorial page, the all-important editorial page. What is your philosophy towards editorials, and how involved will you be in trying to determine the editorial direction of opinion in the newspaper?
Well, our general philosophy of the for the editorial page is that we should support what's good for Baton Rouge. And obviously different people have different views of
That's
what's
right.
good for Baton Rouge. But we hope that we can build some kind of consensus about, you know, some of the things that are, you know, that are good for Baton Rouge. We are, one of the things that we think is good for Baton Rouge and good for Louisiana is open government. And our experience is that secrecy in government nourishes favoritism and corruption, and that often the reasons for secrecy are overstated, and the threats from open government are exaggerated.
Well, good. As the president of the Public Affairs Research Council, I think we'll get along very well on that subject. And on that same topic, we have Bruce from Walden. Bruce, you're on the Jim Inkster Show.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. It's interesting you're talking about openness in government. I was disturbed by an editorial 2 weeks ago, which was about Edward Snowden and the NSA, in which you referred to Snowden as a traitor and referred to Putin as our natural enemy. I mean, this kind of Cold War rhetoric in the absence of even looking at the NSA and its violation of Americans' privacy and a national surveillance direction, I was just really disturbed. It seemed like a real shift in your editorial direction.
Well, I don't think it was a shift in our editorial direction. The people who run our editorial page are the same people who were here all along. And I don't think that's an opinion out of line with the mainstream of American public opinion when it comes to Snowden.
So
it would be interesting to actually talk about the national security issue and not just misdirect people to Snowden as a traitor. What about the main issue?
I'm not sure I understand the question exactly.
Well, I think what he's just trying to get at is if you're in favor of open government, why not be in favor of what Snowden was trying to do? I think that's what he was getting at. But you haven't changed the staff,
staff. The editorial staff is the same people it always was, mm-hmm. And you know, we are in favor of open government. There are cases, even the most strident supporters of open government, and we consider ourselves strident supporters of open government, you know, do not hold the view that everything government does has to be open.
Mm-hmm.
We do not, for example, think that the locations and security arrangements of American troops is something that should be subject to public disclosure. I don't know a lot of Americans who would think that.
Right. So, do you read all the editorials? Do you give advice on how do you choose what the opinions are going to be, or is it a group decision? How are you going about this?
I mean, I would say it's a group decision. It's mostly the same people who were doing it when the Manships owned the newspaper. I don't think our positions have substantially changed in any way since the Manships owned the newspaper. You know, there are some things that an editorial page of a newspaper should stand for, and I would say open government. Within reason, open government is one of them.
Well, you know, The Advocate has a reputation for giving regular drubbings to whoever the governor is in power at the time. They have a reputation for questioning authority. Do you think that you're going to be different or the same as that type of editorial culture?
I mean, newspapers, the business of being in newspapers is questioning government. I think that's what readers expect from newspapers. I think, frankly, that's the role of newspapers in American democracy. And the reason why I think communities need newspapers is to have a powerful voice questioning government on behalf of the citizens.
Now, in your reforming of the newspaper, there, I guess layoffs, is it layoffs or buyouts that you're going through?
I want to say it's buyouts.
Okay.
Okay. Buyouts meaning that it is a financial offer of up to 6 months' pay to people of a certain amount of seniority if they want to leave the company, and it's voluntary.
And what led you to this point?
Well, the size of our staff is, you know, greater than the industry norm for a newspaper our size. There's a formula for how many people you generally have per 1,000 newspapers sold, and that's always been high at The Advocate. And if Gannett had bought The Advocate, they would be laying off a third of the people by now. And even McClatchy, which is not so much of a layoff company, would have laid off 20% of the people by now.
The other thing I notice about The Advocate is they have, compared to other newspapers in the same market size, they seem to have a large news hole. In other words, they tend to run a lot of news in that A section, and you see a lot of other A sections at similar size communities that have just gone down to nothing.
We do, and when I was at the Picayune, people used to complain about the thinness of the newspaper. And The Advocate's news hole is the amount of space dedicated to news versus advertising. And The Advocate's news hole has always been disproportionately large, and we hope to maintain that,
to make it
a good value.
Although regular readers here may not be aware of it, they may not be making that comparison, but it is.
If you go to Lafayette or one of Shreveport or another community in Louisiana, you'd be surprised how thin the newspapers are.
That's right. We have Michael from South Downs. Michael, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
Thank you. I have a criticism of what used to be the magazine section, which is now this smorgasbord, it seems, of travel and art and literary sections, and all of the features seem to be mixed in with one another. It seems to me there ought to be some better way of organizing those different areas.
You know, there might be, and as we evolve, we're trying to listen to suggestions. And, you know, like I said, I've listened to a lot of voicemails. I've talked to a lot of people. One of the things I do in my mornings is I call people who stopped the newspaper for content reasons. And, you know, we keep trying to evolve in line with what our customers want. And I will say, you know, we're one of the only newspapers in America whose circulation is growing. So I think we are good listeners.
Well, it's a remarkable story, no matter what way it goes, Peter, and quite a challenge that you're facing there for any newspaper, really, in this day and age. And we hope you'll come back on the show. I'm sure Jim will want to have you back on sometime to talk more about the things that you're doing. I want to ask you to stick around here and talk a little bit more. We didn't talk about the Dodgers. The Dodgers, and I've been a Braves fan, and Peter's always been a Dodgers fan, and both teams may end up in a National League pennant race. So, you know, you're not perfect, Peter. You are a Dodgers fan. We forgive you.
You know, I always thought that the greatest job on earth would be to be manager of the Dodgers. And at various times the job came open, and even though I'm a great owner of a fantasy baseball team, they passed me over. But actually, I'm enjoying what I'm doing now, and it looks like the Dodgers have a manager who knows how to win. So,
how's your fantasy? That's the Peter Outs, right?
The Peter
that's
Outs,
your fantasy baseball team.
We're in fourth place, and we're I don't think we can overtake the top team this year.
All right, you want to have a wager on Braves Dodgers? You have to wear a Braves hat in the newsroom if the Braves win. I'll do the same with the Dodgers.
Well, we should do it where we go out to lunch and have to, so we can see each other
okay.
doing this.
Okay. Well, that bet is on. Well, Peter, stay with us. You might want to join this conversation about Carmageddon, and this is going to be a discussion with some law enforcement officials about this incident that took place a year ago. And if you want to call in at 297-5633, or if you have an experience with Carmageddon you'd like to relate, 297-5633. We have with us from the Baton Rouge Police Department, Lieutenant Todd Wisher. Todd, are you with us? Todd, hello. Can you hear us? You're on the Jim Inkster Show.
Good morning.
Hi. And we also have State Police Captain Taylor Moss, who is the command technician for Louisiana State Police Emergency Services Unit. Taylor, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Great.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks to both of you for joining us. And let me just set up what took place on August 22nd, 2012. That was a Wednesday, like today. The Baton Rouge metro area was treated to an interstate traffic disaster that pretty much shut down the Baton Rouge street grid, according to one media report about the incident. Pausing for a flipped-over car on I-10 near Essen Lane, a semi-truck with a tanker load of isobutane was rammed by another semi-truck reportedly hauling beer, causing a chemical spill. And as such, one of the two primary arteries in the city and the main route for interstate traffic in New Orleans was shut down for, I guess, about 27 hours. Rerouting interstate traffic to surface streets comically overloaded our street grid capacity, even with a coordinated effort by state and local traffic authorities to synchronize lights on our main surface streets like Airline Highway. The chemical spill and wreckage were cleared late Wednesday night through a vent and burn procedure consisting of two controlled detonations. We all remember the dramatic video when they closed down the highway and blew up the truck and all the isobutane. As a matter of fact, I was stuck in traffic that morning. I was on my way to the Jim Inkster Show. I was going to be a guest on this show, and I couldn't make it because the traffic was snarled up. So I called into the show, and Jim Inkster was stuck. He couldn't get to Rotary Club that day, and he was the speaker at the Baton Rouge Rotary Club. That whole Rotary Club meeting was canceled. Those are small events, but there were many canceled events that day, a lot of lost work time. And so the question comes up, is there some way maybe that could have been avoided? And Captain Moss, I'd like to start with you. Can you just tell us where you were that day and what happened from your perspective?
Yes, sir. Again, thank you for having me. This crash occurred about 3:40 in the morning. My guys were notified. We got out there about 4:15, and the assessment of the vehicle was that it had sustained tremendous amount of damage from the collision. We had the collision damaged the rear of the tractor trailer carrying the isobutane, and it had severed the spray fill line, which was leaking, and it was inoperable, non-repairable. Also, the spring hangers on the trailer itself were broken.
And by the way, Captain, what happened to the beer?
The beer was properly accounted for and transported away safely.
All right. You called a few fraternities over at LSU. Okay. What was your decision making involved in all this?
Well, we had a very dangerous situation. Isobutane is a highly flammable gas. It was under pressure. There was basically four options. We only had four options to deal with this situation. We, as the command and control for this event, including personnel from ExxonMobil, OB Cambry, the Baton Rouge Fire Department, Hazmat, ourselves, and a private entity that eventually did the vent and burn, sat and discussed our options. The first one being a hot tapping, where you actually drill or cut into the tank.
These companies weren't responsible for this. They were giving advice, right?
No, sir. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. The first one, by cutting or drilling, which has never been done successfully on a tractor trailer that we know of. It's a very, very dangerous situation. Lengthy exposure to the emergency responders. It's a lot of time on site, and it just was too dangerous. The other one was cold tapping, where you put attach a valve to the exterior of the tank and attach it by screws. And it had never been successfully done. People have heard that it's been done, but we couldn't find anybody that's done it. We tried to move it, considered moving it, relocating it. The flanges were too damaged. The trailer could not sustain movement. then it brought into account the integrity of the tank frame itself. And once we did move it, what we would do? We would just relocate another problem.
Right.
And it had a serious potential to create a more serious and unmanageable event. On our final option, the option of last resort, was the vent and burn. And
I understand the burn part. What's the vent part?
The vent part, it's where we used a shaped explosive charge, and you place it on the high side, which is the vapor side, the empty, non-fluid side of the top of the trailer, and you also place one on the bottom, on the opposite end of the trailer, on the liquid end. And it's called a controlled burn. I've heard it referred to as we blew it up. Matter of fact, when I tried to explain to the colonel, Colonel Evanson, what we're going to do, he paused for a moment and tried to consider how he was going to explain to the governor how we were going to do this.
It was a massive explosion. Of course, been videos of there, but fortunately it turned out okay. And the idea was to burn up all the material so that there was nothing else to pose
exactly.
a hazard. And this isobutane, it's used as a refrigerant, it's used in aerosol sprays, it's used as a feedstock in the chemical industry. It's a pretty common and important material that we use in our industrial society, and here was a case where it had to be completely eliminated from the highway. Now, Lieutenant Wisher, where were you on this day, and what was your perspective on what was going on?
Well, I usually arrive at work. I was an assistant uniform patrol commander, and me and the uniform patrol commander, Captain Gerald Bloom, arrived in our office shortly before 6 a.m., and we were alerted to the situation by our night shift commander. So immediately what we did was go up to the scene so that we could evaluate, get with our partners, the state police and the fire department, and start an assessment on what manpower we would need. We knew the first thing that was going to be a problem was all the people that we had coming in, as you said earlier, that were coming into town for work. And then we had the transient traffic. And that's what people fail to realize is we have so much transient traffic that's just traversing through the city, coming from, you know, multiple states.
Will come as news to people in Baton Rouge that they're not just commuters on the interstate in the morning. That's what...
Yeah, usually an interstate is used for people to traverse through your city.
Right.
But over the years, and I've lived in Baton Rouge my whole life, it's become just a way to get to work. And that's not really what it was designed to be, but that's the way it ends up in our city. So that was our number one concern, where we were going to get the manpower to handle this situation. So we immediately activated all of our traffic personnel that weren't already on the scene, and our secondary traffic personnel, which would be your people that are ride bicycles downtown, your hit and run division.
Yeah, that's right.
Lieutenant
Wisher, hold those thoughts. We'll be right back to talk about Carmageddon with Baton Rouge Police Department Lieutenant Todd Wisher and State Police Captain Taylor Moss. Jim Inkster Show, stay tuned. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. I'm Robert Travis Scott, President of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana, sitting in for Jim today. We're talking about Carmageddon. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 297-5633. That's 297-5633. We're on the phone with Baton Rouge Police Department Lieutenant Todd Wisher and State Police Captain Taylor Moss, who had important roles in trying to handle Carmageddon a year ago when the traffic snarl gridlocked Baton Rouge due to an isobutane truck accident. Now, first, before we gentlemen, we get back to the questions, we want to play a little clip of a radio interview with Mayor Kip Holden. Now, he was touting his record on infrastructure during his campaign for reelection in 2012. He pointed to his green light program and argued that the parish should invest more tax revenue in roads and bridges. And about 2 months after Carmageddon, Holden spoke with WRKF's Amy Jeffries in a campaign trail interview. And Holden said that in addition to the shortcomings of the city's thoroughfares, the traffic management after the highway shutdown had been deficient. Let's hear that clip from that interview.
Traffic was not directed. It was directed poorly.
you'd have to have a diversion effort put together by the sheriff's office, the state police, and city police. If there is a problem that happens at this point here, here are the alternative routes that we will immediately put into effect and let the public know what those routes are.
Are plans in motion to do that, to both create the plan and to make the public aware of what it would be?
The plans will have to be decided by law enforcement. I have, in other words, I can tell the chief, go ahead and schedule a meeting with the sheriff and also Colonel Edmondson. And y'all need to come up with a comprehensive plan as to how we deal with alternate routing if we have a situation like we had at Essen Lane the last time. And so that's my role in it.
Have you given that direction?
No, ma'am. But I will have to do this in order to make it happen.
Well, there you go. That was Mayor Kip Holden talking to WRKF's Amy Jeffries. Mr. Wisher, maybe you could help address the issue of the traffic control, because that was the big story of the day, in addition to the dramatic explosion. Everyone was gridlocked. Would there have been a better way to handle it?
Well, let me be honest with you, and we've discussed this over and over in our after-action meetings that we have. Prior to becoming Assistant Uniform Patrol Commander, I spent 18 years of my career in traffic. There are certain events that will occur that there is so much volume of traffic that you're pulling off of one area and placing it onto the surface streets that makes it the physics of it, the number of cars that you're placing there onto those surface and feeder streets, you're going to have gridlock. If we had a fantasy police department where we could have an officer at every intersection, let's just say we were coming down US 190 from Denham Springs to Baton Rouge, and people were going in town into work to go to the downtown and different feeder roads off of US 190 Florida Boulevard. Once you put so much traffic off of the interstate onto that to reroute it, there's only so many numbers of cars, and that's what the people don't understand, is there's so many number of cars mathematically by the size of the vehicles that can fit in that space.
And let's I'll make sure that we understand, too. And both 10 and 12 were closed both ways, right? Is that right?
No.
What was exactly closed?
10 east and westbound from Essen Lane at the overpass, east and westbound were closed, so we had no traffic coming in, and it was closed at Segan Lane by state police, and then it was closed inside the city where you couldn't exit Interstate 10 right there where you go to the split for Essen Lane.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You couldn't go there, so we had all that traffic that was coming over the bridge, which we realize comes all the way from California. You have all that traffic coming in that we had to send down 12. But we had all the inbound traffic that were coming from Ascension Parish, Livingston Parish, and where people commute. Each day, we had that traffic coming in for our morning commute.
Hey, let me just add one perspective on this. As I was waiting in traffic that morning, I was trying to get to the Jim Inkster show to be a guest, and I noticed I was trying to cross airline, and airline was almost impossible to cross because it was wide open. Now, was that a hurricane mode type of evacuation plan that was put into place?
Well, what we did is we contacted the traffic engineer's office, and we started giving – you're exactly right. We started giving longer signals, increased the signal time on Airline Highway and on US 190 or Florida Boulevard for the people in Baton Rouge area. We increased those time frames so that we could pull the traffic in from those locations. But it goes back to what I was saying, and we've seen it in hurricane situations where even though we have excellent plans in place with the state police and we're partnering up with neighboring jurisdictions, once you get a certain volume of vehicles on there, just by the sheer volume of the traffic itself, you're gonna get gridlocked.
That's right, and I can easily understand that. I guess one of the questions that has been out there since then is a hurricane evacuation mode. I mean, it sounds like that's a plan to get people out of town, whereas in this case, you had a snarl in which everybody in town still needed to get somewhere else in town. And is there a different type of traffic control mechanism that could be considered for that type of situation as opposed to just trying to get everybody to flee?
You're exactly right. I think that's a point well made. The state police, we've learned after Katrina and events prior to Katrina, where we could take both interstates, both sides of the interstates, and we could evacuate people out. And we saw how fast and how, you know, more efficient that was by doing that. People leaving earlier. This is a non-planned event. You have to get manpower in place. And one thing I want to let you realize is we had a training academy that was down that were downtown that we were able to utilize 30 individuals that we wouldn't have normally had, you know, during that situation. So we immediately evacuated and executed those people to go to places where we had uniform officers already in place that they could assist. And so that helped us tremendously. So
let's go to a caller, HB from Denon Springs. You are on the Jim Inkster Show with Baton Rouge Police Department Lieutenant Todd Wisher and State Police Captain Taylor Moss talking about Carmageddon. HB?
Thank you. The question brings in my mind this, and it's really feasible that it could happen. What if we have, say, a train derailment as we had many years ago between Hammond and Livingston? A tank car blows up at Exxon, multiple instances within a short period of time. What do we do, and how much is public safety in jeopardy with that? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Moss, you want to start with that one?
I hope that never happens. but I can tell you this. We have a lot of law enforcement partners. I want to address one thing that Todd was talking about. What people need to also understand is that we were evacuating that area also. So not only did we have the traffic that was already in place, we had additional people being moved out, joining that traffic that would not normally be joining it. So his department, Baton Rouge PD and his staff did a phenomenal job. I don't think it could have gotten any better. I just wanted to give kudos to Todd and his crew and the chief.
Absolutely. I want to know if you gentlemen are ready for an alien attack. I mean, that's what everybody wants.
Maybe
to.
Zombies are not aliens.
That's right. 2975 zombies, but not aliens. 2975633 to join the conversation about Carmageddon. We have Glenn from on Nicholson. Glenn?
Yes.
Welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
Thank you. I've been dying to ask this question since I saw the video. I was just an observer, so I just saw the only video I saw was on TV, and you could see that little charge go off, I guess, on the top of the car. Maybe the gentleman earlier said that was the vapor.
Looks like we lost Glenn somehow, but I think he was trying to look at the mechanics of the controlled burn.
And now, I can address that.
Yeah.
That what it is it's two different charges. We had the first charge on the top end, which is the vapor area. And what occurred was we set off ESI from Baton Rouge, Explosive Services International, set off the top charge, and seconds later, which relieved the pressure from the tank. There's also a flare up there. When that first charge is detonated, seconds later, we detonated the lower charge, which released the fluid, which was also had a ignited remotely by a flare, and the liquid poured into. We had already pre-established a pit where that fluid would go and catch fire and burn off, and every bit of that isobutane burned off, and it relieved a big concern for us.
Robert Scott sitting in here for Jim Inkster on the Jim Inkster Show. We're talking about Carmageddon, the big traffic snarl a year ago, and we have a caller, David, down at LSU. David, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
I would like to ask, in a situation like this, who would be the ultimate person in charge of traffic control? Because similar to when we had Katrina, there was no one in the state that could turn all the red lights in Baton Rouge on the flashing and allow the people from South Louisiana to pass through.
Baton Rouge, with their, like, you know, north and south, being on, like, a blinking green, a blinking yellow, and the other lights are blinking.
Well, thanks, David. Great question, gentlemen. Who wants to field that one?
I'll answer to inside the city. The traffic engineer has designed, we've designed where we give, he can remotely, not all intersections, but a majority of the intersections, probably going down 190 and on also US 61, they can, from a remote computer, he can change light cycles, and in some situations he can flash those from the computer. So we do have technology now that's growing. We use this technology at the LSU football games where we can extend light period cycles just by calling him up. So we can do it on the fly, per se. That's something that we hadn't been able to done for years. I don't exactly understand. You know, you wouldn't want to flash every light. That wouldn't be, you know, the proper thing to do.
You don't think that would work?
I don't think that would work. But I'd let What do you think about that, Moss?
I'm going to tell you, and I think we're trying to get into a contraflow issue.
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, that's a planned event. We know when it enters the Gulf, we have so many hours, and there is a tremendous amount of planning that goes into that. And what people need to understand is that when we do a contraflow, it's every exit is blocked by a law enforcement officer, whether it's the parish official, city official, or state official.
And we learned a lot about that. If I remember my history correctly, it was Hurricane Yvonne in 2004.
Correct.
When we didn't really have a good contraflow plan in place. The hurricane started coming
in.
There was an evacuation of the New Orleans area. And we've never seen such gridlock in Baton Rouge as we saw that day. And it was a very dangerous situation if a storm, you know, had come through. And what resulted from that is Governor Blanco and state police and others, they got together and said, you know, we're going to fix this. And they created a more robust contraflow plan so that when Katrina actually happened a year later, even though there were still a lot of people left in town, the people who had cars got out and the evacuation and the went fairly well on that level. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. We had to work also with our neighboring states, primarily Mississippi. And Mississippi and Louisiana got together. And because once they, you know, not only are they leaving Baton Rouge or coming to Baton Rouge, they're going east also.
But we did manage to see a problem and fix it.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's the remaining question with this. We had another problem, big traffic snarl, a different kind. Can this be fixed, and can this happen again? Is there a way to prevent it?
Todd, I don't know. I don't know. You know, if you had the same scenario, I don't know if Baton Rouge City or the parish officials, law enforcement, and the state police, traffic could have done any better to try to manage what they had. Because the volume of traffic was unbelievable, and it was it put this city in gridlock. It truly did, and it was unfortunate. A similar circumstance occurred in Houston. They shut down the interstate for 3 days dealing with this just about the same product. We rectified it and mitigated it in 26 hours. And I think we did a phenomenal job. I think Baton Rouge City did a phenomenal job. And I understand it was a big heartache for the motorists in Baton Rouge at the time. But I don't know if we could plan for this type of event and do any better.
Okay. Well, we'll take that back up at some point with the mayor to see if he agrees and whether something more could have been done. How was the news coverage of this event, gentlemen? Of course, we still have Peter Kovacs, the editor of The Advocate, here in the studio. What advice would you give him about coverage of an incident like this?
Todd, you want me to take that?
Yeah, you want to take it, and then
I think it was excellent.
Kind of comment.
We tried to give the media as close a picture as we could safely. We had just about every form of media that Captain Doug Kane handled, and his staff accommodated their requests as much as we could safely.
Was it good, accurate?
Absolutely. I believe it was as accurate as possibly could be. It's this whole this whole process of vent burn is very foreign to a lot of people, and it was foreign to me prior to 3 years ago becoming a commander here. And it's difficult to understand that you're going to put an explosive device on top of a flammable tank and not make it explode or have a controlled burn.
Extraordinary event, extraordinary reaction. Thank you, Lieutenant Todd Wisher with the Baton Rouge Police Department and Captain Taylor Moss with the State Police. Thank you for your service and for being on the Jim Inkster Show today. This is Robert Travis Scott, President of the Public Affairs Research Council, sitting in for Jim Inkster. He will be back in the studio tomorrow. Thanks to Peter Kovacs, the Advocate editor, for being on today. Good luck with all the work you have there. Join us for the next Jim Inkster Show.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.